launched. We get some coverage from TechCrunch and the usual suspect. We get a massive spike in demand, and we thought that was it. First time founder, we made it. And then day three or day four comes along and traffic basically declines by 98%. That was not product market fit. It was quite the opposite.
That's Alex, the founder of Flyer, and they've raised over $400 million from great investors like Peter Thiel and BlackRock. You get to see how they actually hit product market fit despite having a false positive.
After a while, we came to realize consumers don't really pay for advice. So we basically said, lock your airfare. And today, Hopper does this very well. And this is where product market fit arose. We were able to embed the product into websites like TripAdvisor. When you went to buy a flight on TripAdvisor, you would see book my flight or lock my airfare.
They grow quickly here and get to $1 million and then run into scaling issues. So they took a step back and were like, where are we going next? And then this happened.
We got a call from JetBlue Airways and we got a call from Air New Zealand. And they said, hey, if you're so good at forecasting our future pricing and helping consumers arbitrage that pricing, why don't you come and help us to actually price better?
I want you to hear that full snippet to know the sequence. It's About Doing, episode that we just dropped with Shippo's founder. They started an e-commerce store and then saw the problems and then built a scalable company. Keep listening. You'll enjoy it. Boom. We're on a mission to help founders hit product market fit faster. We do this by interviewing founders that have been there. I'm your host, Adam O'Donnell. This podcast is put together by Zendesk for Startups. We offer 6 months free of Zendesk customer support suite for qualified product-oriented companies. Alex, welcome to Sit Down Startup Founder Podcast. So excited to have you here. Can you first tell us what you're building at Flyer?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Great to be here. So at Flyer, we are building what we refer to as the operating system for modern travel companies, primarily airlines and hospitality businesses, effectively powering their decisions, their core systems of record, and their customer experiences that you and I interact with every day when we book a flight to book a hotel.
Very cool. The basics, just making it better, making it easier for them.
Yeah, these travel companies, even though we deal with a multi-trillion dollar industry when it comes to travel, these companies are still running on IBM mainframes and technology that hasn't changed in the last 20 or 30 years. When booking a flight, the experience hasn't changed for the last 20 years. When getting a ticket at the airport, it's still printed on a physical boarding pass with codes that nobody understands. And we really help and renovate and upgrade those technologies together with them, large airlines, large hotel groups, and bring them into the 21st century with that technology.
The heart of this podcast is to understand like what it was like in those early days before you got all the flashy numbers. I know it's not always like that. And also to share founders that it's not up and to the right all the time. Yeah, I'm excited to dive into that. But before, like, tell us a little bit about yourself as a person. Like, where did you grow up? Maybe some a key learning experience then, and then we'll go on.
Yeah, absolutely. I was born and raised in the Netherlands, back in Europe. I finished my high school a bit younger than most. And instead of going to college, I decided to try my luck at building a company in network security. That's where I kind of got exposed to machine learning. In my case, use machine learning and do pattern recognition on network traffic to recognize potential threats to your network. When I was 22 years old, I just packed my bags and I left for Silicon Valley. I wanted to go to the promised land of technology. That's 10 years ago now. I started a company there that was trying to predict the price of airline tickets, and have a predecessor of Flyer. And that morphed over the years into an enterprise software company that powers the reservation systems and pricing systems and booking engines of major airlines and hotels.
Wow. Tell me, when did the seed first get planted as a youngster around moving to the US or starting a big company one day?
Yeah, so I've always been very passionate about both aviation and technology, especially machine learning. And I really wanted to bring those two things together. And I decided to do it in a large market. And there's no bigger market for both aviation related businesses, as well as kind of consumer travel than the United States. On top of that, there's a bit of a saying in Europe that is just be normal, that's more than enough. I didn't feel that was fitting for what I was trying to do. So for all those reasons, I packed my bags and I went to San Francisco. Spent some time in a acceleration program. I think it was the very first batch of a plug and play startup camp 10 years ago. Spent 3 months there to kind of get my footing in the Bay Area, moved to San Francisco, and kind of went from there.
That's amazing. What was your biggest fear? Like, and maybe something that you would share with someone who's considering just going all in on a startup or moving.
Yes, I guess the biggest fear in the early days is denial, right? So the denial by others, right? So whether that is you speak with other people about your idea and they don't quite agree that it's an opportunity, or they actively tell you it's a bad idea. And then thereafter, when you actually go and try and raise some money for that idea, investors saying no more often than they will ever say yes. That's the hardest thing in the very early days. And then you kind of get used to the word no more regularly, and you build perseverance as a founder, and then you build on that going forward. But that's definitely the hardest part of the beginning, and the biggest fear, the fear of being denied by other people, or people telling you the idea is bad, or not wanting to give you capital for it. That's the hardest part in the beginning.
Yeah, I bet that was like every founder is just like, well, like they have this amazing thing and it feels like their baby. They put their identity sometimes in it. And so when you put it out in the world, it's just like anyone can just stomp on it and that's like your heart.
Absolutely, and looking back to 10 years ago, right now, it's much easier to get past this kind of denial or this people telling you no. And very often you look back and you think, well, that actually wasn't an idea I would have invested in myself, but that actually makes you respect the people that did even more.
That's an amazing realization. Wow. Well, I love this. So let's go to your product market fit journey. I like to start with when you thought that you actually hit product market fit, because it is something that I found too often where founders think they have it, but they actually don't.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first one, and this will be very easy to recognize by kind of first-time founders, is we launched first a consumer product. So we started off by trying to predict the price of airline tickets, and then giving consumers that information so they can decide when they should buy or when they should wait buying their ticket. And we launched, we get some coverage from TechCrunch and the usual suspects, and we get a massive spike in demand, and we thought that was it, right? First-time founder, we've made it. And then day three or day four comes along and traffic basically declines by 98%, right? That was not product market fit. It was quite the opposite, right? It's the fact that there wasn't a continued trend, at least a flat or slightly uptrend on demand that indicated the lack of product market fit. But that's the first time that we got it wrong. Then after a while, we came to realize that consumers don't really pay for advice. So we actually packaged our forecasts and we turned them into insurance products. So we basically said, lock your airfare. And today, Hopper, which you might know, it's a mobile app, very successful in travel. Hopper does this very, very well. So lock your airfare for a few dollars. And that product, and this is where product market fit arose, we were able to embed the product into websites like TripAdvisor. And so when you went to buy a flight on TripAdvisor, you would see book my flight or lock my airfare. And we would power that. And we had people paying for that. We grew that business to over $1 million. And that's where we had early product market fit. Not a product we provide today because there were scale limitations to that product market fit. But that was the first time we had a product market fit that people were willing to pay for, that was growing, that wasn't just being recognized by consumers, but also adopted by B2B partners, right? So resellers. But yeah, so lock your airfare based on our forecasting of the price.
Interesting. So how long was the first test where you had
Yeah,
the
so I would say that first kind of period was about a year and a half to 2.5 years, between 1.5 and 2.5 years to really find our product market fit at a meaningful scale, getting to $1 million in revenue. That took us about 2.5 years, I would say.
Interesting. In that 2.5 years is when you made the switch from just straight B2C with the massive coverage spike to then the insurance piece.
That's correct. And that was still a consumer business. And again, this is not the business we are today, right? Because then came the realization that we couldn't really scale that consumer business, even though we were reselling through much bigger travel booking and travel search platforms. And that's when we get a phone call from a couple of airlines. We got a call from JetBlue Airways and we get a call from Air New Zealand. And they said, hey, if you're so good at forecasting our future pricing and helping consumers arbitrage that pricing through insurance, why don't you come and help us to actually price better? And that's when we realized that there actually might be a whole different market for our technology than the consumer, and that was them, the airlines themselves, helping apply our technology to help them price better. And that's when we really took a hard pivot, and we started working with and for the airlines to algorithmically help them optimize their pricing, starting with JetBlue and Air New Zealand.
This is interesting. I would love to zoom into this decision moment where you have something that's hit around $1 million. You've been working on it for 2.5 years. You get some calls. Like, I could just imagine that a bunch of really smart advisors would say, "Hey, this is a distraction. Don't go work for the airlines. Stay with what you're doing." So could you kind of share that decision tree of like the benefits of staying with what you had and the benefits and the cons, all that?
So I think there were a few ways to look at it. So the first one was is we had people reaching out to us, asking us to please supply what we had built for their purpose, right? So I think that was signal number one that was interesting for us. The second thing that was really interesting is when you just look at the numbers, right? These were people asking us, can you help us manage billions of dollars of our revenues, right? So whole scale factor different. I was making a million by selling my product, or I could help other people make billions, so optimize making billions. So that was another kind of factor that kind of weighed into kind of the materiality of considering that switch. And then the third one was is our existing investors and some new ones that we tested the waters with about this pivot really liked the idea of enterprise software, because enterprise software, it is generally high margin, it is highly recurring revenue, and especially when you deal with these very large multi-billion dollar companies, it tends to be very sticky, right? So all those factors fed into the decision to actually pivot the company, reuse the technology, but apply it to price on behalf of the supplier instead of arbitrage the supplier.
Very interesting. Can you tell me with what the cons were, or just the other side of the argument to stay with the
So
B2C?
the biggest challenge was is that we immediately realized that B2B or enterprise into the airline, it would be a very slow sales cycle, a slow adoption cycle. It would cost us more capital to actually go and build out the product, because now we needed a, you know, an enterprise interface to our product. And we needed to deal with the nuances of the user or the analyst that is doing pricing at the airline. So we actually had the cons were we had to go and raise more capital to actually finance our ability to go and do this. And we had to set up our business and be mentally ready to go at it for the long run, because these are very slow sales cycles and adoption cycles. And we knew that very early. And that's really why our transition successfully into that business took us another 2.5 years thereafter. So now you're already 5 years in before you have a product market fit for an enterprise kind of product that is entrusted to manage billions of dollars of other people's revenue, right? So that was really the challenge with our business. And this is where we are very unique. Like our product, yes, we have a minimum viable product, or we had a minimum viable product, but it was less minimum or less minimal than most minimal viable products, because you're basically taking over the responsibility of somebody else's billions of dollars in revenue and pricing, right? So that was kind of unique about our journey.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I want to get to that. I also want to ask, tell me what was the scale problem that you had with the B2C and how did you evaluate that?
Yeah, it's a good point. So a couple of things. So I think in travel in particular, brand loyalty is a big challenge. Price tends to drive most of the consumer decision. And second, your average person doesn't fly every week. They fly once a year or once every 2 years, especially in the United States. So we found that it was impossible to actually build kind of a recurring nature to our customer base. It was every customer was basically a new customer. And that made it very, very hard to convince people of the value of the product, because they didn't, even the ones that experienced the product weren't naturally going to buy it again, because they just don't fly every week, right? And the business traveler that does fly every week or every other week is using the company card. So they don't really care about arbitraging or optimizing when to buy their flight, because the company's paying, right? So that was really a big challenge for us on the consumer side, non-recurring nature of our customers, business travelers that did flyer lot. They didn't really make use of it because they weren't paying out of their own pocket. And it made it really hard. It made every sale the first sale.
And that concept just makes so much sense. And investors don't like businesses like that for those reasons. And that makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering if I could just play like a kind of the devil's advocate, because I think there's probably a lot of founders who are sitting in your shoes back then trying to make the decision. So, because I'm wondering if someone said, well, like there are obviously like Kayak, there's businesses that have figured out how to get around that in other ways. And I'm curious, was it just, did y'all take time trying to look at those options? Or was it more like, you know what, this is everything just aligned. And so that's why we're going.
Yes, I should know that most of the big travel businesses out there where you go and buy your flights or your hotels, they were either established very early when there was not much competition, so they kind of organically became a major brand, or if they were established later, they tend to do so with dramatic capital, right? So hundreds of millions of dollars to go and build those brands as a shopping platform for travel. We didn't have that capital. We didn't have that option to go and do that on the consumer side. So we had to rely on embedding ourselves into their platforms. And the additional challenge that brought with it was that nobody really makes money on flights. So all the money is made in hotels. So another learning for us. And this means that when you go and ask a TripAdvisor or a Kayak or a Priceline to embed your lock your airfare button right alongside the book the airfare button, you're dealing with the long tail 5% of the product team thinking about this stuff, right? So you'll always be priority number 30 on their roadmap, which doesn't help get more traffic and scale either. So that was another reason why it was very hard for us to scale up, because we just weren't a priority. Flights weren't a priority to most of these companies.
Wow, what an interesting learning. Those are just the learnings that you're not going to find in an article, at least like as widely published. You might not know to test it, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So those were all reasons why we decided to just go work for the supply side and help them price billions of dollars worth of product better using machine learning and AI, using their data to establish better pricing strategies that both fill more seats, right? So sell more seats at lower prices, but also maximize the price of those willing to pay for it effectively. And today we do this for JetBlue, for Air New Zealand, for Avianca, for Azul, and a bunch of other names that we've announced that we work with to help them optimize their pricing.
That's so good. Well, so now let's go back in time. Like, you just made the decision, like your founders, your board's on the same page. You're like, we're going to go all in on this B2B model. Yep. What was day one in that startup, even though it's the same company? What was that like? What was the MVP? What were your timelines? What were you pushing for?
Yeah. So the big change when you go and start working with multi-billion dollar public companies is that you have to learn to work with the cadence at which those companies work, right? So even though you can ship fast and you can move fast and like making decisions, those companies don't. They are running on reservation systems that date back to the 80s, pricing and revenue management systems that date back to the 90s. They love their spreadsheets. They love their business processes as they were established. And then here you are, like a small startup, telling them that they're doing it all wrong and that there's better technology to do it, right? So the thing we had to very quickly learn once we committed to make the change was, okay, how do we help change the hearts and minds of these very big enterprise companies? And how do we move both at their speed, but also find ways to make them go faster? And that was a whole different world, because now you're beholden to the other guy to dictate your speed effectively. In terms of development and deployment and rollout. So that was a whole new challenge we had to deal with. The benefit, however, this is still true today, is that once you get into these kind of accounts, you're dealing with 5 to 10 year contracts. So the stickiness of this revenue is incredible, right? You're dealing with millions of dollars of singular contracts per customer and 5 to 10 year terms, right? So suddenly your total contract value of a single customer is 10, 20, 30 million. We have one customer, I can't announce it, but we have one customer where our single contract is $300 million, right? To give you an example. So we sign contracts that are 50 or 100 or $300 million with a single customer, right? So that gives you, and that justifies some of this slow kind of deployment and change management cycle for our technologies.
Yeah, so, I mean, what an amazing example. What an amazing switch. How did you know? So what did you do day one? Did you go and fly to meet them? Maybe they gave you a free ticket. Did you have an MVP? Did you have a demo when you showed it with them?
So I listened to one of your podcasts, and one of the questions you often ask is like, okay, what was kind of the key decision or the key trigger of kind of early growth? And absolutely personal relationships. So the way we actually ended up getting these deals done is we managed to sometimes cold email or get an introduction through board members or investors to the chief commercial officer or even the CEO of these airlines. And we would spend some time with them, build a relationship, explain to them what was wrong about how they were doing it today, and very often actually be given a shot at like proving ourselves right with them. And so those personal relationships, those personal contacts with the C-suite at these airlines very early on, and even still today, helped us get these deals done. Because the middle management of most of the companies we work with is perfectly happy with the technology they have. Right. So we needed a sponsor at the C-suite effectively with these customers to get through to them.
There's no other way. And what did you have to show to get that very first, like, hey, here's some money to test it?
So typically what we did in the early days is we said, okay, instead of charging you a bunch of money for the technology, we will just take a small piece of our incremental performance. So we said, hey, we're going to implement the technology. We will run our pricing on a third of your routes. We're going to compare the performance of those routes with everything else, and we're going to take a small percentage of the incremental revenue we're able to generate. And that means that there's basically no risk for these companies, right? If you make me more money, I'll happily pay you some because the variable cost of a seat to an airline is very low, right? So that's how we kind of got in the door and how we got people to look at us as kind of a risk-free way to improve their revenue performance. Today, we've kind of moved away from that, where we're able to go more traditional, kind of fixed enterprise SaaS deals. But that's how we got in the door early, and that's how we kind of convinced them to pay us by getting in the door based on a performance-based proposition.
What a brilliant, just like lowering that barrier to entry. And they're already like, wow, they're intrigued by this, and they could already see what you had. The MVP almost was like what your previous product was. So they already, it
Correct.
sounds like you already had enough credibility there.
Yeah, and Lawrence Tosi, the founder of WestGap, one of our largest investors, he always likes to say that when Alex came to me, he told me that I've got this piece of technology, it's going to make them a ton of money, and I'm going to give it to them for free, right? And then I'm going to take a small piece of the increment. So, so that's kind of how we got started initially, and then eventually, as we built this referenceability and credibility, we can do more standard kind of fixed price or transactional-based, transaction volume-based SaaS deals.
Yeah, and we all love that for the obvious reasons. I love that. Help us with how much time you spent to build to be able to deliver on that first airline customer from where you previously were.
So it seems to be a little bit of a cadence, and we're very unique in this case. I would say it would took about a year and a half or so to get them to full scale, right? So the and this was mostly because it's very easy to be, we were trying to improve a business process pricing that had existed for decades, and there were many nuances, right? Like when you go on a flight and you want your skis to come along with you, or you want your infant to sit on your lap or have their own seats, or you want to buy extra leg room, or you want to buy business or upgrade, or there's so much complexity to that ecosystem that finishing up the long tail of functionality took us a while, right? So we were able to get kind of 80-20 really quickly, but then the long tail of functionality that truly displaced the prior solutions or business process took quite a while. So that product market fit, that product market maturity, that took another year and a half to kind of get to from that point onwards.
That makes sense. Were they letting you work when you had the 80, or did you were they just like you can't even test it
Yeah,
on us?
we were incredibly fortunate that we had airlines like Air New Zealand and JetBlue supporting us very early on. They were perfectly willing to run large swaths of their network, of their routes on our technology. Even though we didn't check every box there was left to check, and we would not have been able to succeed as a business had they not done this. And I should note, both airlines are also investors in the company because they believed in us as soon as they started seeing signal that there was something there.
That's amazing. Did when you first got live, like what was that moment like when they when one of those Air New Zealand or JetBlue first switched you live?
It was crazy because we were tracking how much revenue have we effectively priced, right? So you set the seat, you set the price for the seat, and it wasn't just thousands of dollars; it was like millions of dollars a day that was ticking up. So we were suddenly in charge of like billions of dollars. Today we are closing in on about $20 billion under management, right? So revenue under management that we control for our customers, and then it's just our pricing technology product. We've diversified since then, but so that was really cool. Like knowing that there's millions of dollars of other people's revenue entrusted and put in our hands to manage and decide on. That was incredible.
That's amazing. Can you take us into that war room? Like, were you on site on their headquarters? Were they like, we want you here?
Well, I'll give you the craziest one, and that is like this rollout was happening about 4 years ago in the middle of COVID. So we were not able to actually be on site. We did the whole first customer rollout in the middle of COVID when it had just kicked off, basically, in 2020, in early 2020. And so we were able to successfully do this rollout with this multi-billion-dollar revenue company in the middle of COVID. I will say, in part, we might have been actually lucky because in COVID the volumes were down so far that there was less revenue at risk for these customers, but we still did it re fully remotely. So our war room wasn't just remote compared to us and the customer; it was remote between everybody in our company. Like we were all doing it on Zoom ourselves. So that was quite interesting to do an enterprise software migration during COVID, remote from the customer and remote from our teammates.
Oh my gosh, with millions and potentially billions in revenue on the line.
Millions of stake. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And what was some of the early issues? I'm curious if you could just pull us in to relate.
Yeah. So it was simple things like, we're dealing with a lot of data feeds coming from the airline, and we hadn't written all the tests that we should have written for all the edge cases. So, like, what happens when an airplane type is switched from an Airbus A320 to a bigger A321? And like, it would mess up our system and our understanding of remaining seats. What would happen if a flight number would change or the departure time would change? Like we had crazy bugs in the system, but luckily, we were on top of that pretty much 24/7. We had around the clock team of engineers kind of keeping their eyes on the system. Our customer never knew how much work was left to do, of course. I'm sure they'll be listening to this at some point, but that was quite intense.
Oh, that's amazing. I can only, and you're doing it all remotely and the world's kind of falling apart. And also you're impacting the airline business at the time of COVID, which is like gotta be historically one of the lowest points in that business. What an amazing time. Maybe could, how much money did you have in the bank at that time? Because I just like I want to understand where you were there in terms of like were you raising money or were you trying to get more sales or were you
So
just heads down?
we had our product kind of ready to go to market in February, March of 2020. And we were going to raise money on the back of kind of this early product market fit and customers coming on board with our product. However, as you can imagine, no investor was touching travel or travel tech when COVID broke out, right? So we were able to miraculously raise a $5 million bridge, our Series B, I guess that was, Series A, B, in early of 2020. That got us through 2020. We placed all of our chips on Air New Zealand in that particular case during the year to kind of prove the product and scale it up and make revenue out of it. And we were able to get through it at that point, thanks to this one investor who invested $5 million. It was one single investor. He said, "Well, we're betting on you guys, and let's hope that this COVID thing goes over soon." And it allowed us to pull through.
What an amazing story. Was that investor, I'm assuming, had already been an investor previously?
Indirectly, but then they directly double down. thereafter. Yeah.
That's amazing. What was your pitch to that investor at that point in time? I'm curious if you could pretend like I was he or
Yeah,
she.
so well, let me think about it. So it was something along the lines of airlines and companies like them are really bad at managing their data. They're really bad at leveraging their data. They best case use simplistic regression methods to forecast the future with all their data and advanced machine learning, deep learning in particular, will be able to understand what's actually happening in the market, especially a volatile time like COVID, and use that understanding to price better than they will ever be able to do. And the investor said, "Well, I believe that you guys are the right bet and you'll figure this out. I just have to keep my fingers crossed that COVID is not going to ruin the opportunity while you try your way at it." So, but it all worked out in the end. That did all work out in the end, and we persevered. Yeah.
What an amazing story. Thank you for sharing that. Can you help me with why they believed in you so much? Because I think that when I was a VC at a small fund called Mighty Capital, like I think that was something I missed when I was a founder as well, is that they're investing in like the top one, two or three teams in the world for that problem based on their
Yep.
track record. How did you convey that?
Yeah. Well, I'm both the ultimate optimist as well as actively trying to be a realist. So I believe that our team, my leadership team, myself, I believe we can move mountains. And I think in front of investors and in front of people and customers, we tend to be pretty good at relaying that confidence in ourselves. At the same time, I'm also pretty clear-eyed about what the risks are, right? In that particular case, COVID was destroying demand. Airlines were going to go from highly profitable to highly loss-leading, so there was no money to invest. But our argument was, we can solve this technology problem, and it is coming at the opportune time where airlines need every penny they can make or every incremental penny they can make to reduce their loss or improve their profitability. And I think that confidence in ourselves, the understanding of the risks, and the understanding of the opportunity that lay somewhere in between, I think was what got people really interested in what we were doing and allowed them to place a bet. And I've been investing in startups like early stage for the last couple of years, and I think that journey has taught me that at the end of the day, it is the people and the belief in their ability to figure it out, whatever that looks like, that's going to drive your decision to do it or not from an investor perspective. And the same thing was true for us.
Really cool, really inspiring. What was the moment? So it's March of 2020. You just launched with Air New Zealand. How many months went by before you confidently said, like, we have figured out the final 20% of the product?
So I would say that was mostly like it was sometime in 2021 when we fully
Okay.
hit 100% of the network. So again, this is a very slow industry, right? Like this is where you're managing billions of dollars, you're dealing with like hundreds and thousands of flights a day, you're impacting the workflow of many analysts at these companies, right? So it's a very slow adoption journey. But again, these are 5, 10 year type contracts, right? So you kind of have visibility on your long-term revenue as you grow.
Yeah, so about a year. But it makes sense. And then when did you start to go actively sell again, or were you doing it during this pilot?
So we well, without n n giving you the numbers, but we maybe a bit more, but we quadrupled our revenues from 2022 to 2023, and we're doubling them again this year. And this is really on the back of product maturity having been achieved in 21 and 2022. So it really took that long. But this is also the moat for us, right? The companies and the technologies we compete with are very monopolistic. They're very legacy. The need to innovate has kind of dissipated. So when a company like us comes along in this very, very traditional industry, and it provides a new and better performing technology, it provides cleaner pricing in the form of SaaS. It's a bunch of people that believe in their ability and their ability to change things. Once you get to that maturity and a product market fit, and you start really actively selling with those mature products, things take off very quickly. So it basically took us 7 years of really hard work and pivoting and finding the right customers and building up the product, to then spend the last 3 years growing incredibly rapidly.
Yeah, and you had the patience is what I'm hearing to do that. What an amazing thing. Well, tell me about your perspective on customer experience when your customers are few but massive.
Yeah, so it's a challenging balance between how do you standardize most of your process, like how do I implement the new customer, versus recognizing that because there are so few, they are also very unique, right? And this applies both to the product. For example, an airline that has a lot of connecting traffic is very different than an airline that has a lot of nonstop, low-cost type travel, as well as the organizations. Some of them are bottom-up organized. Some of them are top-down. The way politics and the way relationships work in the Middle East are very different from how they work in the United States and in Europe. So we basically built a process that allows us to kind of standardize how we implement the technologies and how we train people and how we report on progress, right? The kind of the practical stuff. And then it's a very much personal relationship still today, driven sales and account management process, which each one of the customers that we have and that we sign on going forward. But then again, it's worth it because you have massive contracts for many, many years, and the stickiness of the product is very, very high.
Yeah, that's so good. Well, this has been amazing. I'm trying to think of any other. Is there any other final advice you'd like to share with the founder who was in your shoes maybe in 2019?
I think the most underrated quality of any founder or founding team, I should note, is like that sense and ability of perseverance, right? Like that ability to never give up and that ability to kind of come out of it by working really hard and seeing or visualizing that light at the end of the tunnel. I think it's easy these days to find people with great skills and great ability and that are smart. But I think it's very, very hard to find people or teams that are able to go through pivots and challenges and, end of the world type scenarios from a startup perspective and still keep coming out on the other end and not give up. And I think that's really, really, really important. Determination, the ability to persevere, that I think is important. And reminding, if you're a founder and you're just starting off, remind yourself that other people like myself have gone through this, and it is always those that just don't give up and keep fighting and keep batting.
Just this has been an amazing story. I really appreciate you taking this step by step. I know people are going to learn a lot. Thanks for your perspectives and just thanks for being an inspiration to so many founders.
Thank you, Adam. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If you want to learn more about Zendesk for Startups, check out our website, zendesk.com/startups. Also, we're always looking to improve, so don't hesitate to email me with any feedback on how we can ask better questions, guests to target, or anything else that we can do to better help you as a founder. My email is adam.odonnell@zendesk.com.